Did you get a little tired of watering your garden this summer? If so, you might want to think about adding a gravel garden to your landscape. We'll hear all about them today on Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad to have you with us. Jeff Epping is back with us. He is the former director of horticulture at Old Brick Botanical Gardens and continues to run his own design and consulting business. He specializes in eco-conscious designs for projects ranging from small home gardens to expansive business campuses. Gravel gardens have been a passion for him for a very long time, and he has a new book out about it. It's called The Gravel Garden: Visionary, Drought-Defying, Naturalistic Designs. What would you like to know about creating one? Have you visited one? What are your thoughts? Give us a call with your questions or observations. 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Jeff Epping, thanks so much for being back with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a while.
It's been way too long. You sort of just disappeared on us, Jeff. I was like, how do I get a hold of this guy? But I heard from Mark Dwyer that you had this new book, and so I was very happy for him to put us back into contact. So what decided you on putting this book together?
Well, that's a good question. I was exposed to gravel gardening back in the 90s, visiting Beth Chatto in England.
When you were 10, right?
When I was 10, yeah, something like that. And I was enamored by it, but, you know, I thought, cool, it's a good idea, because she was worried about water. We're using too much water in a garden. And then come around 2006, Roy Diblick, a good friend of mine at Northwind Perennial Farms, put a little gravel garden in at his place, and I saw it, and I thought, all right, maybe I should think about this. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do it right away. I wanted to see how it turned out for him.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, and after a couple of years, I said, okay. In 2008, I put in a gravel garden for Epic Systems. And then in 2009, our first one at Old Brick, and then proceeded with three more, so four at Old Brick. And, you know, after a couple years of gardening in that concept, I was blown away by how easy it was, how little resources had to go into it, you know, from water to mulch, fertilizer, all those things that I didn't need, mm-hmm. Like I did in my other, beds or borders. So I thought, this is something I need to start spreading the word about. So I gave some lectures. You know, we often gave garden tours at Old Brick, and I always hit up the gravel gardens, and people were fascinated by it. I just kept spreading the word, and it came to be my most popular lecture of, you know, probably 20 I gave at the time. And so, and then I don't know what year it was, but a few years back, American Roots, a beautiful book written by Nick McCullough and his wife Allison, and my garden was featured in it, my home garden. And Nick said, Jeff, every time I give the book lecture and show your garden, at the end, I have the most questions about your gravel garden. He said, you need to write a book about that. And I said, oh, yeah, when I retire, I'll do that. Well, I left Old Brick. I didn't really retire, but I left Old Brick, and I thought, okay, it's time. Mm-hmm. And so I reached out to Teresa Woodard, who I worked with many times at Old Brick when she would write gardening articles for different magazines, and Bob Stefko was often the photographer. So those two teamed up with me to put out the book, and it turned out really well. Came out this June.
Yeah, and you know, it's beautiful. It really is. Even if you have no intention of putting in a gravel garden, the pictures are amazing. The ones that I really appreciated were the bird's eye view. I don't know if you took them with drones.
Yes, we did.
Because, you know, we've seen the plans before where you've got the little dots. You know, this is where this goes. This is where that goes. But you never see them actually when things grow. And so by having that view, you really appreciate the design factor.
I appreciate you saying that, because I couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. You know, when you see that top view, then you see all the other views, you can put it all together.
Yes.
And see how it all lays out. Mm-hmm. And so we tried to do that in each garden, but, you know, the government doesn't let you fly a drone next to Iowa State Stadium where we filmed Anna McCracken's beautiful garden, mm-hmm. designed by Kelly Norris, one of the most outstanding gravel gardens I've ever seen. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. Bob is an amazing photographer.
Yes.
Teresa, a great writer. So mm-hmm. we teamed up and kind of co-wrote it together. And Teresa ended up putting a little gravel garden in at her place
as a
result too. So so she's all in, and
she came over to the dry side.
That's right. It just isn't hard to do these days, right?
Oh. No. Well, like I said, when I started out, I mean, I have watered more this year than I think I ever have in a garden, just because it was so dry. It was July into August, right? It was dry here.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know if it's still dry up in the northern part of the state, but.
Yeah, and actually the last several years, our summers and falls have been very, very dry, and it's caused a lot of our plants to perish.
Yes.
It doesn't happen right away, and so people don't realize why things are dying, but it's often because of these crazy dry and hot. How hot has it been lately, too? And what a lot of people don't know, and I encourage anyone to do a little deep dive into aquifer depletion. Just type that into a Google search wherever you're at, and read about what's going on, not only in Wisconsin or the United States, but around the globe. Mm-hmm. Our aquifers are in peril, and so we need to change our ways, because scientists believe that, like, the Ogallala Aquifer could be dried up or unusable for drinking by 2050, maybe 2080 if we're lucky. But we can stop that if we use our water more wisely. Mm-hmm. And with climate change, I think we all want to do something, right? And one way we can help is to create gardens, get rid of some lawn, which we have so much in this country. And it's, of all the things in your garden or your yard, the lawn is the least contributing to the environment.
Yeah.
It really offers nothing for mm-hmm. insects and birds and all those things. And then we dump tons of energy in the form of water, fertilizer, fuel, all those things. Yeah. So give up a little of that sunny patch of lawn, put in a gravel garden, use a bunch of native plants, because most of the plants that we use here, which are super well adapted to these dry conditions, are our native prairie plants.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it depends on where you're at in the world, but there's always plants in your region that will work well.
And that's the point,
situation.
Right, is that you don't use a specific kind of plant. It's the ones that are native to the area where you're putting in the garden.
Well, you try mm-hmm. to use as many natives as possible, mm-hmm. but honestly, I don't use all natives.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I'm very passionate about is that I want, if I'm going to create a garden for somebody, it needs to be beautiful. Because they are not going to give up some space. They're not going to give up some grass if they're putting something in that they feel isn't.
True.
The money, time mm-hmm. and money. So the gravel garden, I try to have things in bloom through the season. So starting out with bulbs. Actually, bulbs do very well in gravel gardens because they're native to dry, gravelly, mountainous regions, most of them. And so they do fine in the summer, just baking in that soil or being dry in it. And they do well. So I can get real early spring color, and then I can use other native and non-native. But really, the prairie plants, most of them bloom when we get a bunch of heat. So that early part of the season, I might depend on more non-native plants. Mm-hmm. But I try to do as many as possible. I'm sure everybody has heard, or if you haven't, check them out, Doug Tallamy.
Oh, yeah.
Telling us about how important native plants are. And even he says, if you can do 70% native in your garden, that is really doing a great service for all the wonderful creatures that live around us, or could live around us if we create something for them, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's kind of the philosophy mm-hmm. then. So you have to have, typically the plants that we use are deep-rooted drought-tolerant perennials, things with big tap roots like pale purple coneflower is one, Baptisias or false indigo is another name for that. All these plants that have these deep root systems,
mm-hmm.
and that's what takes them through these drought periods without a hitch.
So we've probably got people interested in it. So let's just talk about the basics on it. So when we say gravel gardening, we're not talking about like big chunks of rock, right? We're not talking about that horrible landscape rock that we see in front of buildings.
Yeah.
We're talking about tiny little gravel, right?
Yeah, it's like quarter inch size or pea gravel size. Mm-hmm. You know, I often use an angular gravel because it kind of holds together better if we put paths through. But pea gravel works great. And we're not talking about just the dusting over the top,
right?
We're talking about 5 to 6 inches. Some of the gravel gardens that we featured in the book, we featured 20. Some of them have layers of 12 inches of gravel, and they're still, you know, the plants are doing fantastically. So I find that about the 5-6 inch range is good for us. And the gravel we use is a wash gravel. So that pea gravel is a wash gravel, right? Every particle is about the same size. Quartzite is the other one that I use. It's angular. Every particle is about the same size, even though it's angular. So think of marbles in a jar. Mm-hmm. You can shake and push, do whatever you want. You're never going to get rid of that airspace in between those individual marbles. And that's what that gravel does for us. So it maintains that airspace, which cools the soil below. It's a great insulator. It's dry, so there's no amount of moisture in there. And then the plants thrive in that. And it is a very effective barrier to weed seed invasion. Okay, so a seed lands on top. It has to send a root all the way through dry gravel to the soil below, which is pretty tough. However, it does happen from time to time, but 9 times out of 10, if not more, it's the plants that are already in your gravel garden because they are super drought tolerant, and so they are adapted to those types of conditions. Most of our weeds are sort of agricultural, you know, based weeds that like high fertility and lots of moisture, so they really don't, they're not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, will we get a few weeds? Yes, because if you're familiar with a plant like an aster, a dandelion, a goldenrod, the seeds float through the air. If they land right in the crown of an existing plant and we have a wet spring or whatever, they'll probably germinate. But each spring, we go through the garden when we clean it up, and you can see those. You know, as all the plants are emerging from their dormancy, you can see those little weeds here and there. You pull those from the crowns right there, get rid of them when they're easy to pull and get out, and you're good for the season.
Mm-hmm.
So, it sounds too good to be true, and I thought it sounded that way too. And then I tried it, and I'm like, all right, this is great.
I like that you tried it on other places before you put it in your own yard, because your yard is actually a gravel garden now.
Well, I would have put one in sooner, but my wife had other thoughts. But when our front garden got torn up by a street renovation project, I said, all right, now is the time to do it. And she was like, all right. And she had seen it. Others at that point. So she was like, oh, these are pretty beautiful. And that's the thing. This isn't, if you look at the book, you'll see these amazing gardens. And when I think of gravel gardening, it doesn't sound very wonderful.
No,
right?
It sounds like cactus.
Yeah. It sounds dry. And boring, but these gardens are as beautiful as any other.
Yeah.
In fact, if you plant densely, like I tend to design my gravel gardens, you don't even see the gravel except
on the path.
In the early part of the season.
Mm-hmm.
But also the gravel can be kind of a nice negative space, and a couple gardens in the book, like Sean Conway out in Rhode Island. Oh, it's an amazing garden.
Mm-hmm.
He likes that gravel look, and I agree, it's beautiful. So
we're talking about gravel gardens with Jeff Epping. His new book is called The Gravel Garden: Visionary, Drought-Defying, Naturalistic Designs. If you have a question about what a gravel garden is, or maybe you've seen his over at Old Brick Gardens, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email, talk@wpr.org. So if anybody wants to see them, really, Old Brick is a good place here in the southern part of the state, or if you want to travel down here, because the gardens are worth seeing anyway. But they've been in for a long time. I even have one of your pictures that we talked about this about 8-9 years ago, I think, and you sent me some of the pictures.
Yeah.
And so I have one up on our website, wpr.org/garden talk. If you want to see a picture, you will not think that there's gravel involved, other than you may see a little bit of gravel. But let's just start. How do you start? You got someone here who's really interested and tired of watering. I want to do something for the environment. How do I start?
You bet. So find a nice sunny spot.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do great in shade. Most of these plants are you know, want to be in full sun and dry conditions. So find a sunny spot. Then you need to create a border around a garden. And that is because we have that 5 to 6 inches of gravel all the way to the edge of the garden. We want to maintain that. If we just let it fall out, we're going to have all sorts of weeds around the edge, right? Because it'll go from nothing up to 5 to 6. So, and oftentimes you can use a walkway, or a sidewalk, a driveway, foundation of a building. In my case, at home, I used the curb on the street for one of my solos. So you need to do that, and that's about 8 inches or higher, so that when you put the 6 inches of gravel, it retains in there. You don't want it spilling all over, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you get rid of the existing vegetation, however you want to do that. If you want to put down cardboard to kill it, if you want to use a chemical like glyphosate to get whatever it is you want to do, eliminate everything that's there. We don't want anything like quack grass or Canada thistle or something like that, because the gravel won't hold that down, right?
No.
So that's got to be done. Put the gravel in place, and then we
plant
it.
So do you remove any of the soil? Or you just
typically would, you know, get rid of that vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes now I don't even rototill anything anymore because that works up more seeds and ruins the structure of the soil. So you can just leave that down. No weed, barrier, no fabric, anything like that. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm often asked that question. And then we put the gravel in, and then planting is super fun. You just kind of put a good pair of gloves on, dig like a dog, and set the plant in there and push the gravel around. We're not even digging into the soil below. We're just setting the root ball on that, and then it'll root into.
So you want the roots of the plant. Now, you mentioned in your book you want these plants to be, the pots to be about 4 inches. Is
that
right?
Typically you use like quart-sized pots or four and a half inch, 3.5 inch, somewhere in that range.
So the roots are pretty much close to where the soil starts.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, they're usually about 4 inches or so, maybe a little more.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've ever planted something in a pot, you know that the roots go down to the bottom and then they start circling around.
Yeah.
So when you remove the pot, just kind of take off any loose soil. And I always take off on any container plant the top inch, because that's where dormant weed seeds will be waiting for you to water them and get them going. So get rid of that. And then you have that root mass, and then just kind of massage that, and you can easily get it to the 5 to 6 inch range. So when you put it in there in the hole, it's good to go.
And do you use gravel then over the root?
Yeah. So the crown of the plant is at about what it would be, you know, if it were just in normal soil. So the crown is at the surface of the gravel, and then the root mass is in that 5 to 6 inches of gravel, and the roots are touching that soil below.
Okay, all right.
Yep.
And I'm assuming you really should have a plan to where you're going to put these. You don't just say, okay, I've got 50 plants here, I'm just going to kind of scatter them.
That's just a design thing, right?
Yeah,
Don't try to get every plant in the world. You don't need 100 different plants in a 1,000 square foot, a small space. So some repetition. So I always lay them out first, in the pots on top of the gravel, but don't let any soil spill out. And when you plant, and I said you peel off that soil, do it over a bucket or a bushel basket. We don't want to contaminate the gravel and create organic matter within the gravel, okay? Because then we are allowing the weed seeds to have an advantage, because that's what they need, that moisture. So you keep that real clean. And then after you plant, you water. Now, we're planting these because they're drought tolerant, and they are. But any plant needs some time. It needs to root in to that soil below. So in the first week or so, you're watering them as if they were still in a pot. Okay, might be every day, depending on when it is, but just spot water. You don't need to do a ton. And then as time goes on, you just taper them off. And people always say, well, how much for how long? And I said, just look at the plants. Always look at them first thing in the morning. If a plant is wilted first thing in the morning, it needs water. If it's not, may or may not. Because plants, even when they're have the moisture they need, They might wilt in the heat of the day in full sun. Okay, so anyway, you'll get a feel for that if you're a gardener. And then you just wean them off of the water. And then in year two, you might water if we get some, you know, severe drought periods. But then in year three and beyond, I haven't watered my gravel garden at all.
Nice.
So that's the that's the beauty of it. Now, the one super important thing you need to do every spring is clean the garden up, okay? And so you remove all the material. And I always do it in the spring because in the winter, the birds are coming in. I have finches eating the seeds of my compass plants and my cone flowers and things. So, and it looks nice, right? But in the spring, I want to clean it up. So I remove all that. I cut back to stems, leave about 4 to 6 inches a stem. We're learning from ecologists now, right, that that's good for insects, especially bees. They will use those hollow stems or even pithy stems to create a nest and produce the next generation. Mm-hmm. All of the material, I used to, you know, take it to the compost site, right? I don't do that anymore because, again, we know that all these insects, be their eggs, larvae, maybe even adults, are living in that plant material. So now I take it, I cut it into about, I don't know, 18-inch sections if it's longer than that. I make bundle of about, I don't know, a foot across or so, and I just place those in other parts of my garden, not the gravel garden because that's just a small portion of the overall garden, but I tuck them behind shrubs. I do, you know, along my fence line, under my hemlock trees, put them all over the garden and let the insects that are in them release, right? They'll come out at the appropriate time. Mm-hmm. Some early, some later in the season. And then that material becomes part of the mulch for the rest of the garden.
Sure.
Yeah. And, yeah, you know, again, ecologists tell us we need to be messier gardeners. We're too crazy cleaning every little thing up because that's where the insects live.
Yeah, it's the truth. Right. I mean, my philosophy has always been what happens in nature. Because obviously, nature's been doing it for a long time, so yep, they're doing something right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. That, you know, the campaign, leave the leaves.
Yes.
You know, and because all the wonderful insects that we mm-hmm. love, like fireflies, they need wood in your garden. Yeah. They need all these things amongst all the other insects. Yeah. So, but in the gravel garden, I got to clean it up.
Yes.
I got to get all the organic matter out. So I cut it all back, remove it, mm-hmm. usually wait a few days. I have a battery-powered blower. I go through and blow everything else, the little pieces out. Then I'm good for the season. I'm good. And then, I just enjoy the garden for the most part.
So, I mean, but during the summer, if branches from a, you know, tree nearby or whatever blow in, you just
those out. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you might want to tidy up the edges and stuff. So there's a landscape architect at Michigan, University of Michigan, by the name of Joan Nassauer, and she did this big study on people's perception of these messier native gardens that everybody's mm-hmm. creating. And some people just can't wrap their head around that sort of, it's not everything in its proper place, mulch in between every plant, blah, blah, blah. And so she showed images with a hedge around a native planting or a strip of turf or the edges and the pathways, making sure you clip everything along, you know, nothing falling in, just what she calls cues for care, or very formal plants in your garden or sculpture or something that shows that it's a cared for space. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I do kind of clean up, especially the street edge. Things, you know, flow out into the street. If they're in flower, nobody has a problem with that. Especially all the dog walkers. They love it. But after it's done flowering, then I might have to rein it back in a little.
Sure,
but I try
sure.
to do that as little as possible because, again, seeds are important to the mm-hmm. birds and to other yeah. insects that eat them too. So I try to keep as much as I can.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll talk about when we come back after this break about you working with an HOA because that there's a lot of them around and mm-hmm. it can cause a lot of problems. So we'll be back in a little bit, but we are talking with Jeff Epping. He's the former director of horticulture at Old Brick Botanical Gardens, and he's got a new book out. It's called The Gravel Garden: Visionary, Drought-Defying Naturalistic Designs. If you've got a question, please give us a call. Open lines 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nagel. We're talking about gravel gardens with Jeff Epping. Coming up at the top of the hour after the news, we're going to talk about diseases that may be appearing on your fruit plants and trees. And then in the last half hour, we're going to talk about growing bonsais. But we're taking your questions and comments now about gravel gardens. The number 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email, talk@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones. Deborah and Racine, go right ahead.
Hi. I have a kind of a weird question. So we're doing a bathroom remodel. We are doing it now. We gutted it. And whoever did this bathroom back probably, I don't know, like decades ago, because we live in a historic house, put a whole ton of concrete, like laid a ton of concrete on in the bathroom. So we've had to break it all up into all of these small pieces. And I have a whole bunch of buckets of this kind of gravelly sand to kind of golf ball size piece, like refuse of this concrete. Can I reuse this for a gravel garden? I would love, I have a little space in between my garage and patio that I'm like, could I do this? But so I wanted to get your opinion on that.
No, that's great. That's great. In fact, you know, that's another type of drought tolerant gardening designs that people are doing, especially in urban areas, bigger cities. They're using construction rubble, be it from porcelain, concrete, old bricks, all those things, trying to reduce their carbon footprint by keeping them close by and not hauling materials long distances. So yes, there are people doing that. It's really hard to say without seeing exactly what you have, but I would say maybe, mix in some sand with those pieces. You might want to top it off with a pure like layer of say pea gravel or something, because if you use just sand on the surface, it'll be a little easier for weeds to get going in there. But if you have that really well drained mix and have some little crevices in there for things to get rooted in, I think you'll have some success. I know some people who have done a little bit of that, and they're having a lot of fun with it. And some, to be quite honest, I looked at the beginning, I thought, oh my God, I don't think this is ever going to work. And I was completely wrong, and they're beautiful. So again, though, you have to select the right plants, right? You got to have things that are going to thrive in those drier conditions. What direction does that space face? Is it south or
north? So that's good. Yep, that's the issue. It actually is north facing, so it doesn't get a lot of light, and it's a little strip. I was thinking like a Carex albicans or something, maybe.
There's a lot of sedges that are super drought tolerant, even some non-native plants like epimedium might work, but some of the native asters, like Aster divaricatus, which is it's a different genus, Symphyotrichon, I guess, or Eurybia. Anyway.
I wasn't going to correct you, Jeff.
The woodland asters. There's a lot of plants that are really drought tolerant, and because it's in that northern exposure, they won't be as dry as if they were in the southern exposure. So you might have to do some experimenting. I encourage you, there's a gentleman from England. His name is John Little, and he's all over Instagram. Check him out. He does all sorts of cool stuff with what you're talking about, construction debris, and he's does a lot of little video clips too. He's fun and super knowledgeable.
Okay, well, good luck, Deborah. Go ahead and experiment. What's it going to hurt, right? Yeah. Now, does she have to worry about creating some of the bigger chunks that she might have crevices and things that dirt falls into that she has to worry about?
I would probably, it's hard to say what it looks like, but I might break it down into a little bit smaller pieces, because, the roots will find some of those little crevices might be good, but if they're big, solid pieces, you probably won't get much rooting into that.
Okay, get some of your frustrations out, Deborah. Crack it up. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Amy in Cambridge. Hi, Amy.
Hello. I have a question. I was trying to visualize when you were talking about starting, starting one of these gravel gardens. And am I understanding that it's a bit of a raised? Are you kind of building it up a little bit?
I think you kind of cut out there, but I think what you're asking is, do we go up? So the soil, you don't have to remove 6 inches of soil. You actually just create the border 6 to 8 inches higher than the existing soil. Now, if you have an existing sidewalk or curb like I did at my house, there I have to go down on that edge 8 inches. And then I slowly bring that to grade into the bed. So I'm not removing 8 inches for the whole garden. I'm just getting that 8 inches down, and it can be slightly slanted going back into the bed. Take that soil and just throw it back into the bed that you're creating the gravel garden in, and, you know, just rake it all out smooth like you would with any other garden before you, in this case, before you add the gravel. The other thing, when you add the gravel, be careful that you put stakes about every 2 feet through the space, mark that 6-inch mark on each stake. Because when you spread the gravel, it's so easy to have 2 inches here, 10 inches there, whatever. But if you do that, you'll get it consistent, and those are easily, you know, pulled out after the fact. So anyway, but, you know, it's fun just to give it a try. So if you have a small space, like I have between my driveway and the foundation of my house, I have like 2 feet facing south. Perfect spot to give it a try, and you'll probably end up putting the bigger one in later because you'll be like, oh my God, this is too easy.
Although moving gravel around takes a little more muscle than you think. So just to be warned.
True.
And in some cases, you actually will put a border in. I mean, I know I've seen some of those pictures where there's like maybe some rocks or whatever.
Right. You could use landscape, you know, like brick. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of those are really big. Mm-hmm. We did that out at Epic. Actually, that's what they use for their edging. You can use boulders. You could use, and any sorts of things. Or even steel edging if you want to do that.
Just to kind of keep it contained. That's the important part.
Yeah.
Jenna emailed us. She said that she doesn't recommend concrete in the garden because cement mixtures typically contain coal fly ash, about 30%, which may have contaminants like arsenic, mercury, aluminum, stonium, uranium, et cetera,
et cetera. That's what these designers in the urban areas are up against, right? So believe it or not, in England, London, they have certified recycled material that is free of those contaminants.
Nice.
In Chicago, where I've been doing some work with, not so much. So that's what we're kind of trying to figure out, how we can recycle these materials without causing other issues. Mm-hmm. Right?
So don't put vegetables in there.
Right.
Not that you would, but just saying, excuse me.
No, that's a good point.
Yeah. So thank you for that, Jenna. So let's talk about some of those other things in your book, because you do have a lot of examples and you're going all over the world, mostly to Britain, but in the United States. But let's talk about that HOA first. And that is a home here in Madison. And it was in an area with a homeowners association with lots of rules. And the owner wanted to put in this garden in memory of his wife. So tell us about that.
Yeah. That was a couple years back. Mike called me and said he and his wife, Linda, had been to one of my gravel garden talks. Since that time, they moved into a new home in this neighborhood that's, heavily HOA regulated. Sadly, Linda passed away during COVID. Mike wanted to create this garden in her memory. And the first thing he said is, I am not the gardener. Linda was the gardener.
Yeah.
But this sounds like, you know, I could do it. And I said, okay, we can. And then I said, where are you at? And he told me, and I'm like, okay. Well, the first thing we need to do is pitch this to your homeowners association. And I said, I'll be happy to do that. I can, you know, do a little presentation, show them images. I could come to Olbrich, whatever, because I would really like to do this for you. And he said, oh, I got it. I'll talk to him. I said, okay. And then so he did, and he had a conversation. And at the end of that, he said, so what do you think? Are we good? And the president said, absolutely not. No way. And so Mike, being a very smart guy, he said, send me the covenant, please. I want to look it over. So he and I did. there's nothing in the covenant that said that we couldn't do what we did. You know, there's some setbacks. We couldn't do anything on the parkway. Heights of plants needed to be 3 feet or less, all things that we could easily do. And so we did. We created the garden. We actually worked with the lawn care company that mowed his grass for him, because I said, I'm too old to be doing, you know, all that heavy work. And so it was fun. It was fun for them. It was something different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when they were all said and done, they're very proud of what they did, and the garden has turned out beautifully. And what is so fun is that the book, the very front cover, is Mike's garden, the guy who's not a gardener. And we featured a lot of fantastic gardens in the book, mm-hmm. and gardeners. And this is the one that made the front cover because it is so beautiful.
It
and within 2 years'
beautiful.
Time.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So 2 years' time, it looked like $1 million. Yeah. And believe me, there were a lot of people sort of like cocking their heads as they walked by, like, what are these guys up to? And then, you know, 2 years later, people are stopping and thanking him for putting the garden in and providing all that beauty and all the butterflies and mm-hmm. birds and such that utilize it. It's pretty cool.
And that was another one of those overhead views where you can see that compared to all of the other homes in the area. It's like, oh my gosh, what a difference.
Yeah.
I can't believe it didn't inspire other people in the area to do something, even if it was just a little. But
right.
Yeah, and he said it was way easier than he thought as far as the cleanup in the spring went, too.
Yeah, so, you know, Mike's up there in years, like I am too, but he gets a little help cleaning up in the spring now,
sure.
but then the rest of the season, he's good. He's good to go. Yeah. I mean, you know,
so
it's fun.
There's, you know, there are probably HOAs that may be a little bit more persnickety, but, you know, you can work with them, hopefully.
You know, and I think that's changing.
Yeah,
you know, I've
I think
heard
you're
from
right.
a lot of garden designers mm-hmm. around the country. I go to a lot of professional, conferences and such.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are starting to loosen up because they, you know, everybody understands what's going on out here with climate change.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's getting harder for us to live in this heat and dry conditions. But think about all those insects and birds and mammals and all those creatures having to mm-hmm. deal with this and with shrinking habitats as well. So we need to, you know, create gardens that support them. And this type of garden does, which
for
is great.
Sure. Yeah. Now let's talk a little bit about how these kind of gardens are used in cities, because you have a number of examples in the book also.
Hey, yeah, we have a roundabout, actually, and I've always thought those would be the perfect place.
Yeah.
And we're getting more and more and more of them, aren't we?
Yes. I have no problem with them. I am actually pro-roundabout. I know it's controversial, but...
I'm there with you. If I don't have to stop, I'm all
yeah,
for that.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it's Swarthmore College in a suburb of Philadelphia, Swarthmore. They created a new sort of downtown space, put in a big roundabout, and wanted to, you know, make it beautiful. So the college horticulture team put their heads together and ended up putting a beautiful gravel garden in the middle. And then a lot of the parking lot island beds and such, they converted the gravel gardens too, which work out really well. So the only issue with creating a garden like that in an urban space is, especially in, well, not as much there, but here in Madison, our streets are treated with both salt and sand, okay?
True. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the parking lots are as well. So if we create a bed like this, we just have to be cognizant of trying not to pile snow up into those beds. There's usually lots of other opportunities to push the snow somewhere else, because that sand will start to fill in the pore spaces. So a good example of that is at Goodman Pool here in Madison. Years back when I was still at Old Brick, we put in some nice parking lot island beds there that 10 years later still look fantastic. And you know, they're not getting a ton of care. They're getting no supplemental water. And they're doing beautifully. And there's, again, pictures of that in the book. We also mm-hmm. did an old fountain at the Madison Water Utility building, just on Olin Avenue there near the pool. And I remember when I got a call asking if we would be interested in helping him do it. I was like, what? I don't know about this. And then I went over and looked. I was like, oh, we should give this a try. How many derelict fountains are there in this country?
And, too many.
Yeah, and he was faced with, you know, jackhammering the whole thing out and, you know, starting all over, which mm-hmm. was take a lot of energy. Now, these gravel gardens are absolutely gorgeous. And, yeah. you know, and not to demean the crew that works there, but that they're not gardeners, right? They are just maintaining the landscape, which was, you know, a lot of grass, hedges, that sort of thing. And they have taken this garden and done beautifully with it.
And let's face it, I mean, most municipalities just don't have the money to take care of these things anymore.
Exactly.
So it makes sense.
Yep.
We got a call from Vicki in Eau Claire with a question. Go ahead, Vicki.
Hi. My question is, we have a pondless waterfall feature, and so there's elevation and uneven ground. Is that something that you can put a gravel garden around?
Yeah, you can create one as long as it isn't super steep. Okay, so like a 5% grade should be fine. Out at Epic, we actually created, out at Epic, it's pretty cool. The gravel garden is on top of a parking structure that holds 2,000 cars underground. And so this is a very shallow soil profile, about 12 to 18 inches maybe. And we actually created topography by using foam and stuff. So you can have some of it, but not so steep that the gravel will start to, you know, migrate in a heavy rain or something like that. If you have a steeper slope, then you're better off terracing it, right? So to create levels that wouldn't be quite so steep. So yes, you could do that.
That sounds interesting. I think that would look really, really neat. So good luck mm-hmm. with that, Vicki. Take a look at the book. It'll give you some really good ideas about plant combinations and, you know, colors and whatnot. Because part of the book is, you do have this, like, the little squared off areas where you picture the gravel, because there's different colors.
Yep.
And you also recommend trying to get gravel that is, like, native to the area, right?
Right, locally sourced, so you're not spending, you know, because the gravel...
It's heavy.
It's heavy. It's cheap, but you got to get it from there to your home.
Right.
And that's what costs you the money. And it doesn't make any sense to, you know, be hauling stuff halfway across the country. Basically, the gravel just needs to be, you know, similar dimensions. And again, you look at the book, you'll see all the different types of gravel people are using. And it needs to be hard. Mm-hmm. It needs not a softer stone that will break down over time. Because
you don't want to do that.
Compromise the system. Yeah, but it was fun. In the book, I like to think that there's so many beautiful photographs in it that even someone like my wife, who isn't an avid gardener, she loves gardens, appreciates them, could pick up the book and enjoy it.
Yes.
And then under each of the photos that you see, which there's over 600, there's captions. Mm-hmm. And so they describe what's happening in the photo. They're bringing across a lot of technical information that you can, you know, take it or leave it, whether you're a gardener or you're not. So there's just, a lot of great information. Like you said, there's gardens in Iowa, Philadelphia, Illinois, Chicago area, and even one way down in Nacogdoches, Texas.
Yeah, that was one was surprised
one. Yeah,
with Texas. Yeah. But that makes really makes sense in Texas, if you think about it. And so many in Britain who, someone who's not really traveled in Britain, I always think, you know, the lovely cottage gardens and it's green. And it's like, wow, they don't have a lot of water there. That's so interesting to me.
Well, it's like everywhere right now, record temperatures in England and Spain and forest fire all over the world. So things are changing in a big way, and more gardeners there are looking to these drought tolerant solutions. And one in particular is amazing is Knepp Castle. There's several books on the whole story of Knepp and how they're converting an old farm to a more naturalistic landscape, all the animals that are coming in as part of that. And they had a small croquet garden and a swimming pool in a walled space, and it didn't fit into what they were doing there.
But it's a castle. Right?
Well, they blew it up and they created a dry garden, and they tried several different types of gravel and different mixes. But it's amazing. And what they do there is they monitor every creature, every insect, mouse, mammal, you know, what, birds.
Oh my gosh.
And they're doing that in the gravel garden as well and finding like an amazing abundance in such a short period of time. It's only, I think, like 5 years old.
Wow.
It's a really neat story. And again, it's in the book, and get out, go on Instagram or your, you know, social media or whatever,
sure,
and check out more. But it's, yeah, it's something that's making sense all over the globe.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So when are you leading the gravel garden tour?
I'll have to put that together.
Yeah, you should put that together.
Yeah, for sure.
I'll probably sign up for that. So I wanted to talk before we have to let you go. So you've had your garden now for quite a few years in front of your house. Do those plants have to get, you know, divided? Do some of them just die out because they're getting older? I mean, what if you find one you really want to put a new plant in? How do you do that?
Well, that's a good question. What's interesting is that when you garden, traditional garden, fertility is very high. Mm-hmm. In fact, a lot of researchers show now that we're making the fertility way too high in our gardens, which make it even harder to maintain because...
Yeah.
The plants grow faster than they want to or should. They hollow out in the middle, and so then we don't like them because they don't look neat and tidy. But in nature, you mentioned earlier, I like to look to nature, right?
Yeah.
Who divides perennials in nature?
Nobody.
Nobody. And so in the gravel gardens, it's lean and mean. There's not a lot of fertility. We don't fertilize, plants grow at the pace they want to grow at. And so, yeah, the garden, first one at Olbrich 2009, plants are still there. Some things come and go. We've learned a lot of which plants do better than others. Mm-hmm. Something like purple coneflower is short-lived. It's really not a prairie plant. Pale purple coneflower is, and that lasts for a long time. So we've learned some things there. But as nature goes, sometimes you get voles, little meadow mice that come in, and they'll work below the snow line in the winter and literally take out, you know, plants.
Yeah.
So it's still gardening. It's not.
It's not a miracle.
It's not like interior decorating where you set it up and you walk away and it stays the same. So it's still gardening. Mm-hmm. But and you say, you know, replacing plants. Well, I can never leave well enough alone with my garden because I do take some things out because,
sure,
I want to try something new.
Sure.
Because I always want to keep learning, yeah, myself. But mm-hmm. I wouldn't have to.
Yeah. You know. What do you do with your old ones, Jeff? Because, you know.
Oh, I have a big family.
It's probably a list.
I never have a problem getting rid of them. Let's put it that way.
I'm sure you don't. Okay. Well, again, I really think anybody that's interested really needs to pick up this book. It's called The Gravel Garden, Visionary Drought-Defying Naturalistic Designs. And it's Jeff Epping. And I'm sorry, your co-author?
Teresa Woodard and Bob Stefko is the photographer.
Yeah. And like I said, even if you're not really interested in doing one of these, pick it up. Take a look at it, okay, because you're going to enjoy it because it's beautifully designed. The pictures are amazing. And I would guarantee by the end of it, you might be interested in putting a little one in a corner somewhere. So you probably would be. What's next on your agenda, Jeff?
Oh, people say, when are you going to write the second edition?
No.
And I said, it's going to be a while. A book is more work than I gave it credit to be. But it was a lot of fun, and I'm proud of the way it turned out. And honestly, I don't think I'm going to get rich writing a book, but I really wanted to share this information because I really think it's important with the way our climate has changed and will keep changing. So we all need to look to better ways to garden. I'm not thinking that everybody's going to convert their garden to a gravel garden, but a portion of it maybe, right?
Yeah.
And then look at the rest of your garden and think about how you can make it more drought tolerant for the good of Mother Nature. We
Absolutely.
Need to help this planet out.
Yes. Well, it's nice to have options. So thanks so much, Jeff, for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jeff Epping is the former director of horticulture at Olbrich Botanical Gardens and continues to run his own design and consulting business. He specializes in eco-conscious designs for projects ranging from small home gardens to expansive business campuses. Again, the book is Gravel Garden, Visionary Drought-Defying Naturalistic Designs. We'll be back after the news.